Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So, as you guys know, my wife and I had our first child, little Ezra, in the summer. He's looking up at me now. This is our morning ritual where I sometimes he loves to be moved, and I'm there just kind of walking around the kitchen. You guys might have seen the two of us, and sometimes actually that's when these prompt ideas come to mind, and I send them in to you, and then it's great because then I just can wait for the episode to be generated in about 15 minutes with our current pipeline running on Modal, and then I can listen to that and then just kind of peace out. And it's actually pretty great. The two of us are there just listening and enjoying the episodes. Ezra falls asleep. No offense, guys. I keep interested and I keep happy and engaged, and the two of us are very content. I think we could probably spend, Ezra, do you think this is true? Half a day, if not a full day, if we're being very lazy, just sending in prompts and listening to your responses. But here's one that I want to ask you guys. So when Ezra was born, as our first child, firstly at 36, I felt like a dinosaur having my first child at this age, but better late than never. He's fantastic. Everyone loves him to bits, including us, needless to say. My wife did a lot of homework, and that's such a weird term here, but reading books about parenting philosophies and parenting styles and sleep hygiene. And you guys know I'm very open about having adult ADHD. And I think one of the manifestations of ADHD, besides attention, I think the whole concept of attention being so misunderstood by people who don't have ADHD, but one of the ways I encounter it is when I can get my focus on a task, it's great, but sometimes too many different things all at once becomes very overwhelming for me. So when I was getting ready for Ezra, my focus was really on, you know, besides work and all the rest of it, getting our apartment ready, and I didn't really have, I knew if I began getting into all this parenting stuff, it would have just been pushed me over the edge of becoming really stressed. But I did, as we got closer to the due date, I have to be honest, it was a bit superstitious as well. I didn't want to kind of do it too early. That's something I definitely felt. But as we got very close to the finish line of Ezra being born, you know, my wife and I did a first aid course, and then we were like, okay, we're gonna spend a night just watching parenting videos on YouTube. We made it 2 minutes, and everyone was just so stressful. It was kind of like everything that I expected. Like firstly, I think I made it 10 seconds into their first video, and I had become acquainted with the term blowout. A blowout, for those who haven't had the experience, the luxury yet, is when a baby goes to the toilet, and the things that come out of their body escape the confine of the nappy. So video 1, 2, and 3 all dive deep into blowouts. You know, I don't know if you guys think we should have an episode about blowouts. Let's put it on the long list for now. And that was my introduction. And I have to be honest, it was really off-putting. Now, when Ezra was born, my reflex, and this probably just says more about maybe me being kind of a techie person, my age, was, oh, I better get an app on my phone for this, right? Which is kind of, when we buy a modem or a router, we get an app, and you feel like you're doing something constructive, even if it's illusory. So I install the baby apps of the day, the leading baby apps, and they're very good, but I was kind of installing these on my phone one after the other and not finding one that I liked, because I'm like, this is way too, again, overwhelming. The idea of logging every single, it boggled my mind that there were buttons for all these things that could be logged. The funniest thing, I mean, I find this kind of funny, was for breastfeeding. You could have a separate timer for each breast. that the baby was feeding from. You could append notes for that breastfeeding session. You could, I mean, it just goes on and on. You could log their sleep, their mood, their gaze, clinical notes. So when trying to get my wife to install stuff on her phone technology, and to my surprise, she actually kind of started using this, but in a more kind of pared down way, like not doing the kind of crazy tracking that they wanted. So she's doing that, and I kind of chip in with my data here and there. I say, yes, there was a nappy change. So if one of us is away or takes over care, we can see what was when the last time his nappy was changed, all these kind of mundane details. But I still think it's kind of, I'm not sure it really helps, to be honest. But I have an idea for what would help. And I, ironically, I find I can find 20 baby tracking apps and zero of this. Ezra, as I mentioned, 6 months. I don't like looking at the world WHO chart. You know, the doctors are on top of it. He's doing okay. Sometimes they tell us about minute deviations, like 1%. He's fallen 1% below this line on the chart. And again, it feels like just an overload of small picture data. What I'd love to know is more things like, okay, he's 6 months, 6.5 months. Like, how is his reality changing right now? How is the world, his sensory world, how he relates to us? What are things that he's going to start doing? How is he going to start changing? Like, what do I need to know to be better equipped and better informed as a carer? I would find that information vastly more useful than all this tracking stuff, because my opinion about healthcare, I guess, has kind of shifted a bit over the years since moving to Israel. I'm now much more of a, you know, and I say this without any shame. I've used ChatGPT extensively, and my wife will would agree with me on this. We both found it surprisingly good in a way that Googling symptoms really was not. We found it non-alarmist, and it does a good job. I kind of ask questions like, hey, what's this thing? Is this normal? And it'll do a very good job at saying, you know, this is like something to talk about with your doctor urgently, or this is an really an emergency, go now, which thankfully hasn't happened yet. But in one case, it said this might be, and we called the phone line. So it's done a tremendous job, and it's been a huge asset. So the kind of useful things, I guess, that I think how technology has helped us as parents and how it's been a hindrance is actually not really the apps I'm seeing on the market. What's helped is when I go into ChatGPT or whatever it is, and I ask those questions like I'm asking you guys, saying, just give me a high level. I hate to use that business jargon, but just explain to me at this point in their life, like, should we be socializing or like what? Like, and then usually asking, give me what the science says, evidence-based, but like, don't overwhelm me with studies. Just give me the general consensus around these topics. And it's been so good at that. It's been so good, as I mentioned, at those kind of routine, I won't even call them medical. Often it's just like really questions that I feel I'm a dummy to even ask. Like, how does this milk warmer device work? Like, is it this button? Do I put this here? I throw out the manual. And all these things about how to parent. I find there's something kind of ironic about the fact that in order to be licensed to drive on the road, right, we need to do, especially here in Israel, they have a very robust training course. And even to renew, I had to do a training course just to change my license over and go to like kind of ground school for days. And then I was like, when we had our child and I was holding her the first time and asking ChatGPT my first parenting question, I was like, hang on, why is it that we have these, you know, we kind of equip people proactively with what they need to know for a lot of different things in life. When it comes to maybe the most important thing of caring for a child, some jurisdictions, some countries do it. My sister says she did a course that was subsidized by the NHS in the UK. But here I definitely wasn't aware of any options. And we did the first aid course because we sought it out. It wasn't something that like we would have got any information about her, and it was nominally priced, but not something that kind of was a standard part of the care basket. So sorry, Herman and Corinne. I think I've set a new record for the longest prompt I've ever sent you guys. It'll be good. It's good to see if the pipeline holds up to this one. What I'm asking really is the kind of technology I'm thinking about. Maybe just for dads and mothers, getting, you know, the bigger picture side upon your, upon the development of your, of your little person or people. Why, what is there? Is there anything that I might find useful? And also, as I've mentioned it, let's talk about pre-parenting education. When did the concept start, and why is every country not, especially with a strong public healthcare system, why is that not like a standard thing across the globe now? Herman and Corn, let's talk about parenting apps and being prepared to become a parent.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, and I am sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem, looking out at the morning light, thinking about how much life can change in just a few months.
And I am Herman Poppleberry, your resident seeker of deep dives and research papers. Usually, we are talking about servers or data brokers, but today, we have something a bit more human. Our housemate Daniel sent us a voice note this morning while he was walking around the kitchen with his son, Ezra.
It was actually pretty sweet hearing Ezra in the background of that prompt. Daniel and his wife had their first child this summer, and it sounds like they are right in the thick of it. He is grappling with something that I think a lot of new parents feel, but don't always articulate well, which is the tension between the technology we have and the support we actually need.
Precisely. Daniel was talking about how overwhelming these minute detail apps can be. You know the ones. The ones that want you to log every milliliter of milk, every diaper change, every second of a nap. It turns parenting into a data entry job.
It really does. And for someone like Daniel, who mentioned his attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that kind of granular tracking can be a recipe for a total sensory and mental overload. He is looking for something more holistic, something that explains the why behind the what.
I love the way he framed it, too. He wants to understand the sensory world of his child, not just the output of his child. And he raised a really provocative question about why we require more training to drive a car than we do to bring a human being into the world.
It is a heavy one. So today, we are going to dig into the state of parenting tech, why generative artificial intelligence is actually changing the game for medical anxiety, the science of a baby's developing world, and that big philosophical question of pre-parenting education.
Let's start with the app fatigue. Corn, have you ever looked at these top-rated baby tracking apps? It is like looking at a project management dashboard for a Fortune 500 company.
I have, and it is exhausting. I think there is this underlying assumption in Silicon Valley that more data equals more control, and therefore more control equals less anxiety. But in parenting, it often works the exact opposite way. If you are tracking a breastfeeding timer for each side, like Daniel mentioned, you aren't looking at your baby. You are looking at a progress bar on a screen.
Right. You are optimizing for the metric instead of the relationship. There is a term for this in sociology called the quantified self, where we start to view our biological processes as data points to be hacked or improved. When you apply that to a three-month-old, you are basically treating a human being like a high-performance engine.
And the problem is that babies don't follow a linear data path. One day they eat 4 ounces, the next day they eat 2. If the app shows a red trend line because of that, a parent who is already sleep-deprived is going to spiral.
That is where the Dr. Google problem comes in. Daniel mentioned that searching for symptoms on Google is an absolute nightmare, and he is right. Google's search algorithm is designed for engagement and broadness. If you type in, baby has a red bump, the search results are going to give you everything from dry skin to rare tropical disease. Because the rare tropical disease gets more clicks, it often ranks higher than it should in the mental hierarchy of a worried parent.
It is an anxiety engine. But what Daniel said about using large language models like ChatGPT for advice really struck me. He called it non-alarmist and said it provides a clear consensus. That is actually a huge shift in how we interact with medical information.
It is a massive shift. Research suggests that parents may trust AI-generated medical advice highly when the source is anonymous, often rating the AI text as credible and trustworthy. It is fascinating because, technically, these models are just predicting the next word in a sentence based on a massive corpus of data. But because they have been trained on medical textbooks, pediatric guidelines, and parent forums, they can synthesize a middle ground answer. Instead of giving you a list of 10 terrifying possibilities, an artificial intelligence can say, based on general pediatric consensus, a red bump is usually this, but keep an eye out for these 3 specific things.
It provides context. Google gives you raw data. The artificial intelligence provides a narrative. And for a parent, narrative is what calms the nervous system. It's the difference between someone handing you a dictionary and someone telling you a story that makes sense.
Exactly, and I think we should talk about the consensus part. When you ask a well-aligned model a question about, say, sleep training or starting solids, it isn't just giving you one person's opinion. It is summarizing the prevailing wisdom of the last 20 years of pediatrics. It filters out the fringe, stuff that usually clutters up search results. Though, we should note, pediatricians are still better at spotting actual developmental delays. Some research indicates that AI may be less effective than doctors at identifying potential developmental delays.
So it's great for calming you down, but you still need that human expert for the high-stakes stuff. But Daniel wanted to go deeper than just, is this normal? He wanted tech that explains how Ezra's sensory world is changing. Herman, you've been reading up on developmental milestones. What is actually happening in a 6-month-old's head that an app isn't telling us?
Oh, it is incredible. At 6 months, which is right where Ezra is, the brain is going through this massive synaptic pruning and reorganization. Their vision is undergoing a huge shift. While they won't have adult-level clarity until they are about 3 or 4 years old, 6 months is the sweet spot where depth perception really clicks. They are finally seeing the world in 3 dimensions.
So when Ezra is looking at a toy, he isn't just seeing a shape. He is seeing its position in space relative to him.
Right, and he is starting to realize that he can manipulate that space. This is also the age where object permanence starts to kick in. Earlier on, if you hit a ball under a blanket, it basically ceased to exist for the baby. Now the baby starts to realize, hey, that ball is still there, it's just covered. That is a massive cognitive leap. It's the beginning of symbolic thought.
See? That is so much more interesting than a sleep log. If an app told me, your baby is currently learning that objects exist even when they are hidden, I would spend my day playing peekaboo and feeling like a scientist, rather than feeling like a failure because he only napped for 40 minutes.
Precisely. There is a famous set of books and an app called The Wonder Weeks that tries to do this. They call these periods leaps. Now, I have to put on my researcher hat here and say that the scientific community is a bit split on the Wonder Weeks. Some studies have struggled to replicate the exact timing of these leaps, and critics argue that every baby develops at their own pace. But even if the timing isn't a perfect science, the framework is helpful because it reframes a fussy period as a sign of growth rather than a problem to be fixed.
It's like a software update. The system is buggy while the new code is being installed.
That is a perfect analogy, and if we had developmental tech instead of tracking tech, we could focus on things like joint attention. That is when a baby looks at an object, then looks at you, then back at the object. It is the foundation of all human communication. If an app prompted a parent to look for joint attention milestones, it would encourage the kind of bonding that actually matters for long-term emotional health.
I wonder why we don't have more of that. Is it just easier to code a timer than it is to explain developmental psychology?
Part of it is definitely the ease of measurement bias. It is very easy to measure ounces of formula. It is very hard to measure the quality of a social-emotional connection. But I also think there is a market pressure to keep parents in the app. If you are logging every diaper, you are opening that app 10 times a day. If you are just reading about developmental leaps, you might only open it once a week.
That is the attention economy at work, even in the nursery. It's a bit grim when you think about it. But let's move to Daniel's other big point, the driver's license for parents. This is such a spicy topic. Why is it that I have to take a written test and a practical exam to drive a 1-ton piece of metal, but I can just walk out of a hospital with a tiny human being and 0 instructions?
It is a classic policy paradox. In many countries, including here in Israel and in the United States, there is a very strong cultural emphasis on parental autonomy and privacy. The idea of the state mandating education for parents feels Orwellian to a lot of people. They see it as an infringement on the family unit.
But we mandate education for everything else that involves public safety. If a parent is ill-equipped, it doesn't just affect the child. It affects the community, the school system, the healthcare system. It's a public health issue.
It absolutely is. There is a famous study from the early 2000s called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACES. it showed a direct correlation between childhood trauma or neglect and long-term health outcomes like heart disease, obesity, and even life expectancy. Proactive parenting education is arguably the most effective preventative medicine we have.
Daniel mentioned his sister in the United Kingdom had a course subsidized by the National Health Service. That seems like a middle ground. It isn't a license you have to earn, but it's a resource that is pushed to you as a standard of care.
The United Kingdom actually has a very interesting model with health visitors. Every new parent gets a series of visits from a trained professional. However, even there, it can be a bit of a postcode lottery where the quality of support depends on where you live. But the principle is sound. It normalizes the idea that you aren't supposed to know how to do this automatically.
I think that is the biggest misconception we need to bust. This idea that parental instinct is all you need. Instinct helps you keep the baby alive in a cave 10,000 years ago. But instinct doesn't tell you how to navigate the digital world, or how to manage a modern sleep schedule, or how to identify postpartum depression.
Right. Instinct doesn't teach you co-regulation, which is the scientific term for how a parent's calm nervous system helps soothe a baby's stressed nervous system. That is a skill you have to learn. It involves understanding your own triggers and how they reflect back onto the child.
So, if we were to design a pre-parenting curriculum, what would be the core subjects? If it were up to you, Herman, what's on the syllabus?
First would be the biological basis of attachment. Understanding that a baby isn't manipulating you when they cry, they are literally incapable of that. Their prefrontal cortex hasn't developed yet. They are just a bundle of reflexes and needs. If parents understood that, it would eliminate so much resentment.
That's a huge one. I'd add the science of sleep. Not just how to get them to sleep, but understanding sleep cycles. Knowing that it is normal for a baby to wake up every 2 hours because their cycles are shorter than ours. If you know it is normal, you don't feel like you're doing something wrong.
And I would add emotional intelligence for the parent. We talk so much about the baby, but the parent is the operating system. The baby runs on. If the parent is crashing, the baby is going to have errors. We need to teach parents how to identify their own burnout and how to ask for help before they hit a breaking point.
It is interesting that we call it parenting, which sounds like a verb you do to a child. But it is really a relationship. It is an interaction.
Exactly. And I think technology could actually help with the education gap without being mandatory. Imagine if, instead of a tracking app, you had a parenting mentor artificial intelligence that sent you a 5-minute video once a week. Not a how-to video, but a what's happening in your baby's brain video.
Like a weekly Ezra update. This week, Ezra is starting to recognize faces from across the room. Try making different expressions and see how he mimics you.
Yes, that turns the parent into an observer and a participant, rather than a data logger. It gamifies the connection, rather than the output.
I also want to touch on the driver's license idea from an economic perspective. If a government invested in mandatory, high-quality parenting education, the return on investment would be staggering. You'd see lower rates of developmental delays, fewer emergency room visits for preventable accidents, and eventually, lower crime rates and higher workplace productivity.
There is a Nobel Prize-winning economist named James Heckman who spent years researching this. He developed what is now called the Heckman Curve. It shows that the highest economic return on any social investment comes from the earliest years of a child's life, specifically from birth to age 5. Every dollar spent on early childhood development saves the state between $7 and $13 in the long run. Some economists project that when you factor in multi-generational benefits, the return could be even higher.
That is an incredible return. So, why aren't we doing it?
Politics. The benefits of that investment don't show up for 20 years. Most politicians are looking at the next 4 years. It is a classic long-term thinking failure. Plus, as we mentioned, there is that cultural resistance to government in the home.
It's a shame, but I think the bottom-up approach Daniel is using, where he is seeking out consensus via artificial intelligence, is a sign of things to come. If the system won't provide the education, parents will find it themselves using these new tools.
I agree. But we have to be careful. While artificial intelligence is great at consensus, it can still hallucinate or give outdated advice if it isn't connected to a verified medical database. We are in this middle period, where the tech is powerful but not yet fully medical grade for everyone.
That's a fair point. You still need that human in the loop. Like Daniel's first aid course, you can't learn CPR from a chatbot as effectively as you can from a person with a mannequin.
Definitely. There is a tactile element to parenting that tech can't replace. You can't app your way into knowing how to swaddle a squirming infant. That requires muscle memory.
So, let's look at the practical takeaways for Daniel and for other parents who might be feeling this data fatigue. What can they actually do today to move toward a more sensory and relationship-focused approach?
My first suggestion would be the delete and observe challenge. Pick one thing you are tracking that stresses you out. Maybe it's the exact duration of every nap, and stop tracking it for 48 hours. Instead, spend those 48 hours just watching for cues. Is the baby rubbing their eyes? Are they turning away from light? Learn the language of the baby instead of the language of the app.
I love that. My takeaway would be to use artificial intelligence as a developmental coach rather than just a symptom checker. Instead of asking why is he crying, ask what are some activities I can do with a 6-month-old to encourage depth perception? Or how can I practice co-regulation when I'm feeling stressed? Use the tech to build your own skills.
And for the pre-parenting side, if you are an expecting parent or know one, look for evidence-based parenting resources. There are amazing programs like Triple P, which stands for Positive Parenting Program or Incredible Years. These are research-backed curricula that actually teach you the how of the relationship. Don't wait for the government to mandate it. Seek it out as if you were studying for a master's degree. Because, in a way, you are.
It really is the most complex job in the world. And yet, we treat it like a hobby you're just supposed to pick up as you go.
It's the only job where you start with a 24-hour shift on day one with no training and a boss who screams at you and can't speak English.
Ha! When you put it that way, it's a miracle any of us survive. But hearing Daniel talk about Ezra, it's clear there is so much joy there, even in the blowouts and the sleepless nights.
That is the second-order effect of good parenting tech. If the tech reduces the logistical stress, it clears the mental space for that joy. That is what we should be optimizing for, not maximum data, but maximum presence.
Maximum presence. I think that's the title of our hypothetical parenting app. No timers, just presence prompts.
I'd subscribe to that.
Well, this has been a really enlightening dive. Daniel, thank you for sending that in. It's a beautiful thing to see you and your wife navigating this with so much intentionality. Ezra is a lucky kid.
He really is. And to all the other parents out there, or future parents, we hope this gave you a little bit of a higher level perspective on the tools you're using. You are more than a data point, and so is your baby.
If you're enjoying these deep dives, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps other curious people find the show.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. We love seeing where these prompts take us. You can find all our past episodes and a contact form at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We're also on Spotify, of course.
Thanks for listening to My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
And I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week with another rabbit hole to explore.
Until then, stay curious. And maybe put the phone down and just look at the baby for a bit.
Good advice, Korn. See you all next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.